used to be with it. But then they changed what it was. Now what I'm with isn't it, and what's it seems weird and scary to me. It'll happen to you.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast. Unusual to have an Abe Simpson on here and not be Old Man Yells at Cloud. But we've gone with either way. I am Rob Coldit, joined on this episode by Zoe Carr. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you for having me.
Nick Mihai, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Excellent to have all of you along for the pod this week. We'll get into it shortly. But to start off, we have some intro music we haven't heard for a little while now.
It's the coach shout out. The coach shout out.
Easily my least preferred intro music. However, the premise behind it is excellent. So this coach shout out is to the legend that is Dave Herbert. Came to the Northeast Bush Rangers to run some sessions with our Northeast Bushies playing and academy groups on Sunday, and Herbie didn't stop. He was on the floor from 11:30 a.m. through to 5 p.m., multiple age groups and sessions, literally nonstop. We had to force him to have a food break at one point. You can see why he's so good at what he does, and you can see why all of the elite people in whatever field it is are elite. The passion, commitment, the demand for excellence, the joy in the work, fantastic day for the athletes, and also coach development. So cracking job, Dave Herbert, on that one. We obviously use him for a lot of coach education stuff on our end as well, but fantastic to see him getting up there. Of course, if you do have any coaches that you would like to throw a shout out to, you can just send those through coaching@basketballvictoria.com.au, or you can slide into the Instagram DMs and we'll pick it up from there. The topic for today, things you used to believe in but now don't. Basketball edition. We're not going like ghosts or anything like that. We're going legitimate things you used to believe in from a basketball.
So not conspiracy theories or anything.
No. We're saving that for...
No, because we very much still believe
that's
in
that. That's why Rob deleted that list I first sent, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Man, who knew JFK? So what we're getting into is the basketball space. So I'm happy to start this one off today. My first one is I used to believe that jump balls were great for the sport. No jump balls were great for the sport.
I was going to say, the first one, I was like, yeah. I did forget
to write my own notes on this one, as it turns out. I thought the possession arrow was a great idea. Like, it sped the game up, it was better. Now I can't stand it. It gets to the end of a game, you fight, you dive on the loose ball for a possession, you have a great defensive set, and all of a sudden you manage to tie a team up, jump ball, and they get the ball back. And it just feels like it deflates the entire game, as you're almost just going off luck as to what it looks like on that. For mine, bring back the jump ball, like in all facets.
Yeah, I like it in like under eights. That's and fine. Under tens, yeah, like especially domestic. Like how many times have you watched they jump throw ball, the jump ball, jump ball, jump ball, jump ball, jump ball.
No issue with that one.
But yeah, in the older age groups. Yeah, and like... Mm. Tip plays and all that kind of fun stuff. It was awesome. It was so good. And
the foot wrestle for who can get the inside spot.
Like, that's what I was going to say. Like, you can even, like, coaches have lost a little bit of the art of being able to draw up a play off a jump ball because you kind of don't invest in it. There's only one at the start and that's it, right?
What's the point?
Yeah, you kind of go, this is how we're going to start. You have a base of it. But, like, that's what I miss as well. I'm all on board for bringing the jump ball back so you can draw some stuff up and run some cool actions.
But also, as you say, Rob, too, reward D.
Yeah.
Like if you come up with it, at least wrestle for it and create that kind of not so much turnover but almost turnover, you should have an opportunity to be able to have a crack at it.
Yeah, I don't know the shot clock for those that play with it, you know, will give you a little bit of a hand on that. It won't reset or anything like that. You'll keep them at the same number. But, yeah, I don't love it. Like it doesn't feel like we're rewarding the right thing, I suppose, in that sort of space.
Does it speed it up? Does it? Is it working that way?
Because I think it does for the young kids.
Oh, like, yeah, true.
If you sort of think under eights, under tens, like it's not unusual to go jump ball hits the deck, four kids dog pile on top of it, and we're going jump ball again. Like it's that kind of stuff. Like, I can see the benefit there. But I think competitive basketball, I'm happy to do away with it personally. Mm. It's just not for me. So, yeah, I used to believe it was a really good thing. Now I'm not so sure. In fact, I'm not so sure. Don't like it. Like it's just not for me. Nick, your first one. Hit us with it.
Okay. I thought you had the list, but you didn't. So
no, I have the list.
Okay,
I'm just making you do some work.
Yeah, okay, all right. Yeah, jeez. Oh, I think I'm going back on probation pretty quick here.
We're going to move back to the morning pods.
Yeah, these afternoon pods are not going in my favour.
I've had a lot of emails today. Let me just leave it at that.
No, that's why we have to definitely do this at 10 a.m. before we get to those emails. So, okay, system wins immediately and is better long term. So, like, I used to think, like, yeah, you know, they've got to learn this structure and how to cut and how to run, and a lot of it was on zero without any defense. And once they learn this, then they'll understand how to score. And it'll also help them in the long run to be able to play team sport as opposed to individual sport. Like, that was just something that I thought early on, but it never actually translated, right? Like, because every time I did 5-on-0, I always ended up at the same point where I had to teach them the decisions within the actions, and I always ended up at the same point. So the start there, so just, you know, something I believed at the start, to be honest, whether it was naive or not, I don't know.
Yeah, I think most coaches go through that at some point. And to be honest, maybe not even early. Like, that might be 2 or 3 years into their coaching where they just get so transfixed with system stuff. And it's like, we have to get this right first. And it's like, well, do we? Like, it's, you know, it's nice to have, but it's not the vital stuff, I wouldn't have thought. And look, it's very easy to go down the tactical side, I think, of coaching. Like, it's, we all get enamored with that because that's probably where the fun stuff is for a lot of us. But yeah, like, teaching a system, and this is, I mean, how I normally would explain it to coaches. It's like, you're going to spend all this time putting a system in to potentially go and play for a different coach that runs a different system. Mm. And all that dead time you've just wasted on something they're now not going to use potentially 6 to 12 months.
But even shorter term than that, right? Like, there was moments where I go back and look at it and go, what was I doing? Where there'd be games where I go, I'm going to keep running this until we get it right, even though I haven't realized maybe there's a reason why it's not working. Yeah. And why am I doing it if it's not working? Why am I trying to persist with this?
Yep.
You know?
That makes sense. And again, I think we've all been there at some point. It's just, you know, it's the chicken and the egg, except I think there's a fairly obvious answer in this one. That, you know, teach the decision making and the skill set stuff first, and then you can play in whichever system you want to play in that sort of space. So, Zoe, your first one.
I'm going to go with the numbering system. And so when I say that, I mean...
House numbers?
No, they're very important. I'm going to go with, you know, your point guards being 1 and then your shooting guards or your off guard being 2, 3, 4, 5.
What about the naming convention? So, like, point guard, shooting guard, small forward, power forward.
Even that.
Same?
Yeah, yep. Even that. I'm a believer in guards and bigs, and guards are interchangeable with each other and bigs are interchangeable with each other. And I think for mine that would flow into any system that they have, because more often than not, the first option, particularly for the bigs, is to have a rim runner. And how often we see kids in particular not rim run because they're not the 5 at that stage. Like that, or, you know, that wasn't their job. Yeah. That was their, or the 4 and the 5 both rim run because the 4 was first, but the 5's job is to rim run.
I've got to tell you, that is not a problem I've usually had in my teams. I'm usually screaming on the sidelines for just someone to rim run. I don't even care if it's the point guard. Yeah. Like, I rarely get 2.
I'm doing that right now.
Yeah.
But it's those sort of things. And we talk about not pigeonholing kids and stuff like that. And I think, you know, if you're a legitimate center, you still need to be able to set screens on the wing or dribble handoff on the wing and roll yourself back onto the basket and those sort of things. You, in this day and age, you need to at least be able to shoot like the foul line jumper sort of level. Ideally, you know, be able to stretch to the 3, but that's not always possible. But that foul line sort of 15-foot range I think by doing that, by saying like you're a 5, it almost says you don't have to worry about all of these other things if you want to go and play, you know, at an international level or have the basketball take you around the world. You do need to do those things because that's effectively what they're doing over there. So, and similarly, especially in like really young, say, right, you're the 1, And the amount of times they could have a layup if they just ran, but instead they're coming back to the ball because they're the one that has to handle the ball. And so for mine, if the ball is outletted to a guard, whoever that is, that's their job to handle the ball and bring the ball up the floor.
So at what age would you start to get some role clarity and positions in place?
For girls, probably around bottom age 16s, I would say, if like you're a big and you're a guard, because by then there's not a lot of room for growth left.
Do you believe in wings? Physical growth. Do you believe in wings or is it just guards and bigs for you? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because I believe wings should have to pinch in the one, you know, if they need to and bring the ball up the floor. You see the amount of times that, you know, the designated one is being absolutely hounded for the entire game. Get towards the, you know, towards the end of the game and all of a sudden it's turnover, turnover, turnover because they're spent. But because they're the one, they're the ones that have to handle the ball. So giving, I think breaking those really strict sort of, you know, you're a one, you're a two, you're a three. No, you're all just guards and you two are bigs and then you play out of that. But it's not for everyone, but I've found it, especially when I've coached teams, found it pretty successful.
It's definitely embedded in the basketball culture, isn't it? Because I've had feedback from my players this year going, hey, you know, you play me in a four, but I want to transition to a three or a two. And I go, I have no idea what you're talking about because I don't know where the four is in all this or where the three is or where the two is for that matter. So, like, it's definitely embedded in the culture of, like, I need to, you know, I need to be in this position to be the most successful. Yeah. Like basketball, like, it was probably that linear in the 80s, right, and probably early 90s. Now the skill level has dramatically increased and therefore there's crossover between positions and that's essentially why the wings is getting removed and it's just guards and bigs now.
But also, what did that sort of 90s era have?
Michael Jordan.
Well, yes.
That was great.
Patrick Ewing. Yep. I just wanted to bring up the Knicks again. Yep.
System offense, like terminal offense. The one runs to here, the two runs this lane. There was triangles, there was shuffles, there was Princeton. There were all these things that were flex, like, but you have to run to this spot and you have to run to that spot and that's what it was. So those numbers were important because it meant that you were the person that went to that spot. Now we're trying to say, especially from a developmental perspective, we're trying to say that run the floor. Go and try and get a layup, and then if you can't, we'll sort it from there.
What is funny, though, is thinking about that as you're talking through it, and we are going down the path of positionless basketball effectively, like play your role and all that sort of stuff. One thing to play devil's advocate that I did like about, you know, the system type days is you got a real feeling of, similar to what you were talking about before, Nick, play together as a group, and sometimes you're going to have to do some things to sacrifice for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those still exist in our sport as it is on the offensive end and all those sorts of things. They're probably not quite as obvious. And that it's not so much you have to go and set this screen to get that person open. It is, what did the defense tell you to do?
But also sometimes it is. Positionless basketball doesn't mean it can't be pointed basketball.
No, I agree.
You can't have something to get a specific athlete a specific shot. You know, you can still run into that stuff. It's more if you're in the flow of it, playing out of your positions as guards or bigs rather than, you know, oh, I'm the one, even though I'm at the halfway line and the two is right there ready to get the catch, I'm going to come all the way back.
Oh, no, I get what you're saying.
You know, like that sort of stuff.
Completely get it.
You know, and, you know, let the fours and fives run off the on-ball screen every now and again or whatever it is in your offense, especially young. I think it's important from a development perspective. And then when you get into like WNBL, NBL and even NBL 1 where, you know, winning starts to matter, well then, yeah, you can run your offense that is you have to go get this person open. But how do you become that person? If you're only ever the person who screens for that person, if that makes sense.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, my next one is that fear is the best motivator. When you think about coaching, fear is probably not the path you want to go down with your players fear you as a coach. That usually means lack of self-control, lack of communication skills, only one way to deal with things. It's my way or it's not at all. And don't get me wrong, have been the fearful coach over the years. I am certainly not pleading ignorance or a lack of accountability on this end, because I have been there and I've seen it work at times, but I've also seen the fallout when it doesn't work in particular. There's a big difference between holding players accountable and having them fear you. And that emotional regulation and the psychological safety that we talk about a lot as coaches is paramount to having a cohesive environment where players want to continue to come back and play and thrive in that environment, rather than I'm too scared to do something here because I don't want to be the one that's going to be yelled at. It doesn't mean you can't be direct. It doesn't mean you can't hold them accountable. It doesn't mean you can't have rules in place for whatever you want to do. You absolutely can. However, that instability of, is this going to be the time the coach goes off? That is not a healthy spot for your team to be in. And I leant in it far too early in my coaching career as that was the way to coach. And to be fair to myself, because, you know, why would I be fair to anyone else? I look at some of the coaches I was around at that time. That's how they coached and that's how I thought it had to look. So it is one of those areas too where I like to think I've evolved a little bit as a coach now, that, you know, players wouldn't fear me. If anything, they're probably a little bit too far the other way, where it's like they don't fear me anywhere near enough and are a little bit loose at times. But it is, there's a line in there. And I don't think you want to cross that line where you're going into fear. Accountable is one thing, but fear is another. And for mine, that's just not how we want to be as coaches.
I think we all kind of went through that period, right? Like at the start, that fearful coach, and we realized that conversations and like just working together with a task actually is so much more powerful and effective.
Oh, so meaningful.
Like it's there's even like exercises that state teams used to do. I think Dom did it actually, where he used to put a player in a chair and they would have to compliment the player. And he goes, "How'd you feel?" He goes, "Uncomfortable, awkward." He goes, "So weird. We live in a society where we're just, it's easier to just be harsh and fearful," and like, and just to touch on what you said, but like, I do think you have definitely transitioned from that, not only with teams, but
well,
also
it was maybe a little worse than I thought.
No, but it's also we're seeing change in the coaching cohort as well,
of course.
Right? Because you're obviously saying it out to the coaches, out in the public as well, and that's definitely changing the scope of it as well, because we definitely at the very start, like especially when I first started coaching, that was just how you coached.
Oh, what did we see? You know, we saw Bobby Knight throwing the chair across the court.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, yeah, we saw it all the time. That's what was modeled.
Correct.
So
we thought that's the
way. Like, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for us. It's like,
yeah. No, also, back in that day, athletes were different.
Yeah, it doesn't make it right.
No, I'm just saying they were different in the sense that because of how athletes were, it allowed coaches to coach like that.
Yep.
Because of, and it was also a society thing. Kids were to be quiet and to do what they're told. And there was a real, not authoritarianism, but there was like this real, adults are in charge.
You can still be honest though. You just don't have, like you can still, I believe you can still do most of those things. You just don't have to put them in a state of fear.
No.
On it, there's a big difference between accountability, like you were saying, and making them afraid to make a decision, or you know, the old player shoulder check.
Yeah.
You know, is he going to yell at me when I'm coming through? What's
It's funny.
Or the shoulder slump when they know it's coming.
Yeah,
I was talking to a player. We're going back 10, 15 years now. That played for two of probably what I would have said are the best coaches that we had in Victoria at the time. Played for both of them, one at a state level and one at a club level. And I'm like, which one? Like, are you more scared of? And one was a fairly loud and out there coach, and the other one was a fairly quiet and subdued coach. They're like the quiet one by far. I'm like, you've got to be kidding. Like, why that one? They're like, man, when they say some stuff, it cuts.
Yep.
Like, it really hits like that. I'm almost fearful of letting them down rather than fearful of what they might say to me. Like, you can say whatever you want to me. It won't, you know, it won't even make a chink in the armor. Like, it doesn't worry me at all. But, you know, sometimes when you get some feedback and it's really direct, like that hits. And that's the scary part of it, I suppose, is we don't really realize the words and the, you know, the impact that has. And similar with body language. We don't always realize the impact their body language can potentially have on players as well. So either way, fear is not the way to go forward. And I would strongly suggest go against that. coaches, at your own peril. Nick, we're on to you for the next one.
Some kids are not good decision makers. So just to...
You used to believe they were?
No,
I used to believe they weren't. That there's some kids, you know what, they just we got to really dictate when they have to pass a ball and move the ball because they just can't make decisions.
Yep.
You know, I truly believe, like, if you're playing basketball and you're at a certain skill level and you're in the appropriate skill level, you can make those decisions. It's just whether or not you've sold it to make that decision, or you've made it, maybe you have to make it more obvious than you've previously said. So there were some times where I wouldn't pigeonhole them position-wise, but I would determine, well, this player can't play in this spot because they don't make great decisions. They don't know how to come out of a ball screen. They don't know how to use a ball screen. They don't know how to use a stagger screen or whatever it is. Like, I just believe that, yes, there's other things like skill development that comes into it, whether you're a shooter or a driver, but I truly believe that every player could be improve their decision-making because it's just choices, right?
Mm-hmm. And at the risk of channeling like full Roy Keane, that's your job.
Yeah, exactly.
As a coach, like, do your job. Like, if they're not good at it, find a way to get them better at it. That's the challenge. And look, we're potentially putting a lot on volunteer coaches in that space as well. Like, not every kid will go from, you know, can't make a decision at all to like John Stockton off the pick and roll. Like, we're not expecting that, but there can certainly be room for improvement, I think, in all of that as well.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if it's, I think the skill shouldn't, I think Zoe said this, skill shouldn't dictate the decision, right? Yep. So there's always that'll play part in it as well. Like, if the left-hand pass isn't one available and they can't make the left-hand pass, work on the left-hand pass. Doesn't mean that they're bad decision makers. Yep. It just means they can't make a left-hand pass. So that's your job now.
Yep.
So it's not always just telling them what the decision is. It's helping them make the decision with the skills that they have as well.
Yep. All right, Zoe, on to your next one.
Shooting technique should be taught the same for everyone. There are some, I used to think everything should all be the same and everyone's shot should look the same, or their technique should look the same, especially when you're in like form shooting and et cetera. And with a bit of, I guess, evolution and understanding that, you know, all levers are different and all athletes are different and makeups of their body, et cetera, that they can't all be the same. And it's about finding what is efficient and what is high quality for each athlete versus trying to, I guess, push them into what my idea of a good shot technique is, because I remember having an athlete who naturally just sort of tilted her feet to the side, and I was into her, like, hard about it. Your feet have to be straight, your feet have to be straight, your feet have to be straight. And she couldn't make a shot. So what I'd done is taken a reasonably good shooter and made her worse by trying to change that. And part of it came because of her makeup of her body and being tight in the hips. So that opens her up and is able to align. And we talk about the non-negotiables in shooting and, you know, shooting line is probably a big one. That allowed her, because of her body, to be aligned. And I was taking that away because I've always been told your feet had to be straight. So, I try and spend more time finding what works for the athlete versus what, you know, the cookie cutter.
There are some commonalities that you want to see in each of them. Yeah. You'd want to see like a snap of the wrist and those sort of things.
Well, like I said, the alignment. Yeah. You want
that's what I was
going
to say too, like the participation sort of coach. Like when we're talking about their space as well, there is when you say, hey, I used to be strict on it and I'm not anymore. What part of it? You're talking about the feet, but like the shooting hands, like can both hands stay up? Can one drop down?
Look at how like Japan shoot the ball.
That's what I mean.
In particular, that's almost like a push pass with two hands.
Oh,
like,
really?
It's crazy, but it goes in.
Yeah, right. So,
and that's how they shoot. That's my point is it's more if you've got an athlete that, can shoot the ball consistently and efficiently. So it's not taking them, you know, five seconds to get their shot away. Does it get changed?
Yep.
Mm. You know, like it's that's hard. That takes a lot of, I guess, time and experience in coaching to be able to make that call. But yeah, if you had have dropped me in, say, Japan, for example, 10 years ago, I'd have gone mental trying to change all their shots instead of just recognizing that it works for them. And now I don't know the reason why, but it does. Mm. There's this, you know, there's not one way for everybody. And like you said, there are some non-negotiables. But ultimately, every athlete is different and no two people are going to have the exact same shot technique.
Yep. Excellent. All right, on to the next one. And it sort of ties in a little bit with what you were just talking about then. More reps equals more improvement. Not the case. Like it's just one of those things that, yes, hard work will get you a long way down the road. There's no question. Sitting on your couch playing Call of Duty will not make you a better basketball player. Sorry, Nick, just how it works. It's just one of those areas.
He got my mailbag.
Yeah, you've got to do some work to get better. There's no question. Like if you go and practice, invariably you will more likely get better. But it is not a case of I need to shoot 1,000 shots a day, otherwise I'm going to go backwards. What type of shots are you taking? Mm. Are you taking them when you're tired? Are you only taking them when you're fresh? Are you only taking form shots? Are you taking them off the bounce? Are you taking them with a defender? Are you taking them from a bad pass that's come out rather than the pristine pass that hits you on the hands all the time? More reps does not necessarily equal more improvement. Don't get me wrong. I am a big advocate for go and do the work. No issue at all. But have some variety in how you do the work to make sure that it is game-like, if nothing else. Like we've all played those little like 3-2-1 games in the backyard where it's like you got to try and get your shot before the buzzer goes off and all those sorts of things. Practice that. If that's the shot you want to be able to take in a game, practice it for sure. But again, very niche skill to be able to go and do that. So more reps does not necessarily equal better. I think better reps equals better.
Exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. More is not better. Better is better. I mean, like a good example of it is, isn't there that little town in Brazil where all the good soccer players come out of?
Well, there's a few. There's a Russian school or a Russian town in Russia, obviously, about tennis. I think it was like I think it was in a game of tennis. They spoke about it where they just produced like tennis player after tennis player after tennis player, and it was largely to do with the coaching, but it's a cracking read. But it happens
in that environment. Like I know with the soccer players as well, they were so good because the generations and generations of good soccer players would play against the other soccer players, and they would learn off the previous ones who would you could triple the hours you're playing or practicing soccer, but you still won't get the value of that little town.
Well,
unfortunately,
the amount of like free play soccer they play there,
yeah,
as well, where it's the 14-year-old plays against the 19-year-old, mm-hmm. and they just play in the streets and they figure it out, and it's
there's the goalpost here, there's a goalpost over there.
That's just what it is, and there's something to it. That's good reps.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily. I'm going to go and lock myself in the gym and just get bulk shots up. That's not what that ends up being. You've got to try and survive. Like if you're the 14-year-old kid, figure it out. Mm-hmm. Like that's kind of what it looks like being. If you're the 19-year-old kid, you don't want to lose to the 14-year-old.
Correct.
So you can't just overpower all the time. Like you might default back to that. But again, when that kid's 19, what are you going to do then? Mm-hmm. Like that's kind of the challenge, I think. So I'd like to see probably more game-like reps rather than just reps for rep's sake.
We used to, at the COE, have to shoot between 500 and 1,000 shots a week. And you had to break down how you shot them. So they all couldn't be the same shot.
Yep.
Layups, free throws, threes, all that sort of stuff. However, 45 minutes of one-on-one counted to like 300 shots. Like that's how they ranked it almost. And so what it did was it was like, I can't be bothered being in the gym for long enough to do 1,000 shots, but I could give you, three bouts of 45 minutes of one-on-one and then 100 free throws or, something like that. It was, yeah, it was a good way of almost getting us to just compete on our own. Yep. But again, the shots that you then take in that, they're tough. Like, their game pace, you're tired because one-on-one.
Never the same.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, there was nothing I've used it already, but like nothing cookie cutter about it. It was all this, like, just the game was teaching us how to shoot.
And there are times, like, we've all seen, like, the Steve Nash 20-minute workout where he, like, bounces from side to side and all the way through and chase that. But it's not bad. Like, if you're looking for stuff to do, I would recommend go and do it. Like, that's, you can find worse shooting drills out than that. But I do think you need to practice how you play, or play how you practice, whichever way around.
Variety
practice and play should be linked.
Yeah, well, variety is the key, right? Like, yep. If you get your reps up, get your reps up. Okay, yep. But it can't be all of it, right? You need to incorporate some sort of one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three, and I know that's easier said than done, but, like, you do have your team training sessions, you do have your Friday night games, you do have your domestic, and there's plenty of basketball out there to get those reps in.
Yeah.
Definitely. All right, Nick, we're on to you for the next one.
Some bigs aren't good rollers, and that just means, you know, some of the bigs, when they set screens, they just can't roll to the basket. I used to believe this. I do not believe it at all. There is no reason, and this is probably more of a rant.
Ooh.
No.
Damn.
Oh, Zoe got one. Anyway.
back to 10 a.m.
But some bigs, like, yes, you can pop if the decision is to pop, but you need to be able to roll and finish at the basket. I'm sorry. Like, if you're playing a big and you're setting a screen, you should be able to roll. Like, it is as simple as that. I don't, you know, I'm not going to be a big when I'm in the future leagues where I go to the high league. Cool. Still need to learn it. Mm. You know, like, it's, you know, oh, I won't play in the low post so much. I want to play on the perimeter. I'm more of a wing. Cool. Still need to learn it. Like, it's still the same thing. I used to believe that, where it's like, oh, this four is more of a popper and then they can flare and stuff. No, if you need to have it as an option.
Yep. Don't mind that at all.
Yeah. I think what's interesting is everybody thinks they have to be a, you know, like a
stretch five.
Well, the six.
It's worse than that.
If you're 6 foot two, you have to be a wing. And it's like, well, actually, 6 foot two, 6 foot three is, like, more often than not a center in the WNBA. Like, you know, and obviously there's the male equivalent, but.
Well, Ben Wallace.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was, what, 6'4"? 6'4",
I think. Yeah. Charles Barkley was maybe 6'6".
Yeah.
But I reckon 6'4" as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and whilst, you know, especially in the men's game, for every one of those, there's probably a lot that haven't,
of course,
you know, been able to make the jump. But this obsession with, you know, I'm not a four, you know, again, the fours and the threes, like, they can be, like, inverted, and they can play different positions and do all of that. I
can't tell the difference between the two. I think that's what you're trying to say too,
especially,
right?
Especially, like, not at the moment, not today, in today's game. So, yeah, I think, you know, get a skill set is the most important part. Get a skill set that can get you noticed, and then you can start and work on some other stuff. But, you know, the amount of times I also see athletes that are, say, bigs and they want to transition, their limbs won't allow them to. Like, their limbs, you've got to be almost, like, biomechanically serviced to be able to play on the perimeter. And sometimes that's just not the case. So go and lean in and be the best big you can be. And get the most out of your game.
And your advantage might be as a big. Like, you might just you might be a little bit stronger, which doesn't make you as agile. That's okay, but that's an advantage in the big position as well. The other thing that's funny when they transition, or they want to transition, and I ask them, well, what are you working on? And it's always like, oh, you know, I've been working on my shot, been working on my dribbling left and right, because I know you've got to be able to be a Swiss Army knife and handle the ball and be able to pass both hands. And I go, you haven't even mentioned defense once. Like, come on, man.
I mean, that's long been said, you know, you are what you can defend.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you can't defend that position, you can't play that position.
100%,
yeah. Yeah, it's a big thing. Zoe, we're on to your next one.
Ripping the ball like below your knees and above your shoelaces, like when it used to be you'd catch it and you'd rip it. I was big on that, and I taught so many kids that that's how they needed to, if they were going to put the ball to the floor, that's how they needed to do it. And obviously with a lot of those now being called travels, I've done a bit of a disservice to those kids. But
especially internationally.
Yeah.
Like it's amazing how many times that, you know, catch on your inside foot as you're coming out of the corner, rip it over the top of your laces, cross over, ball hits the floor. That'll just get called straight away. Always. They won't even think about it. Even if it's not travel, it'll get called travel.
Correct.
Isn't that why the throwdown dribble came in? Because Correct. Of Very the international so. Yep. FIBA refs just going, travel, travel, yep. travel. Yep.
And it's just it's not to say don't be strong with the ball or tough with the ball. Of course you have to be, but to get the ball to the floor, if you're going to use your dribble, get to the ball to the floor as quickly as possible, and that – as well as defenders are getting too quick now too. So, you know, you rip, that takes that time and they can adjust to that, whereas if in the throwdown you're obviously a little more quick and a little more efficient. So, but that was a big one for me. I remember spending so much time with under 12s teaching that, and I just feel awful about it now.
And it's funny how you get those, and it takes a long time for kids to get that right. You show them a throwdown once and it's like in straight away and they're using it within like 3 minutes. It's crazy how much easier it is. So, yeah, absolutely go to the throwdown. If you don't know what that is, send us an email. We'll sort you out with some video.
I feel like the under 12s and under, we're kind of doing throwdowns already.
Yeah.
Right? After just, their three steps.
Yeah, they just like, you know, they never ripped sure. anyway. It was more the older age groups.
It's that like were when they changed the travel rules. It's like, oh, can you explain the rules? It's like, no, but, you know, chances are it's all legal now anyway. Like they traveled before, now they actually can. So don't worry about it. Like it's an easy one. My next one on this one. I used to believe that alley drill was a great sign of who could play. And think of alley drill, like player in the corner facing the other end of the floor with a defender in front of them. The offense would have to take two dribbles, then make a crossover, and the defense would have to slide. And then you go two dribbles back the other way and they'd have to make a crossover and the defense would slide. And the big variable was like when you get to half court, check the ball, and then you get to play one-on-one. It's like this was the biggest waste of time. Like it genuinely made zero difference. No one became a better ball handler out of it, because why would you? Like you get to going two dribbles and a crossover. Like that doesn't help you. Defensively, it's the most predictable thing in the world. You know what's coming. It's two dribbles and a crossover. Like that doesn't make you any better. It defeats the purpose of it. I would rather you play one-on-one in the full court and just go and just work it out rather than the old two slides. Who slides anymore for a start? Like that doesn't even exist in the sport. So I used to be a big believer in that, like especially early on in a trial, it's like, let's go alley drill and let's put them in the corner and see which kids can defend and let's see which kids can handle the ball. I'm no smarter for knowing at the end of that thing.
Like and then your poor bigs are absolutely corked by the time
they're fried. You've got no chance. 10 minutes into trials.
What's this stance thing of turning the ball in the backcourt? I've never had to do this before. This is awful.
Can't I just stand back here and lock off down the line?
Exactly. Yes, mate, we're playing a 1-2-1-1 press. You'll be fine at the back of that thing. Don't have to worry about it.
Like there was a time in the backcourt where you had to turn them instead of send them and shade them to the side of the floor.
Wasn't that a rough time for your defenders?
Oh, how many times they just blew straight through the middle right as soon as you opened the gates?
And don't get me wrong, there's still an element of you need to be able to keep the ball in the backcourt at times, but probably not quite the same way. But yeah. Alley drill, gone. Like it's I'd be the only time I'd use it is if my team was really annoying me and I just wanted to prove a point. And that never happens. So yeah, that's not one that I would recommend be featuring in too many training sessions moving forward. Nick, on to your next one.
I needed to be present and involved in every possession. Now, of course, presence probably the wrong word. Of course you're present because you need to see what actions, need to see how people are defending, those sorts of things. But what I mean by that is I felt like, hey, the players need me to help dictate what they're in, when they need to cut, when they need to screen. And I look back on that and go, well, I must have been like really energetic in my younger age, because I can't think of anything more exhausting than to try and do that now. And I actually look back and don't know how I picked up on how teams were defending us, how they were in D-trans, who were the key shooters. I don't know how I picked up on that, because I was too busy telling my own team every single decision. It was just this false notion at the start that like they need you there. You need to be present. You need to coach every possession, which you do, but that doesn't mean to dictate every single decision.
Yeah. At what point does it become noise?
Yeah.
Like, that's the reality. Like, how much do you honestly think your players are listening to you as they're trying to make a decision on an inside foot catch on the wing as to, should I throw this over my laces or should I just go throw down? Like, it's and the answer is throw down, of course. But it is.
I can assure you they're not listening to me, Rob. This season as well, like, by the way.
You know, but that's what it is. They're not paying any attention to that. They're trying to live in the moment of what's going on in front of them and make decisions. They can't hear all that sort of stuff. The best chance you have is calling a player over at free throws or something like that, and you can convey a message there, obviously. But, yeah, they can't hear what's going on. Like, it's just noise to them.
Yeah, because they're too busy trying to figure out what's in front of them, right, exactly. In live. So it's funny, like, at the start, we just go, how come I told you to do that? Like, even in the past tense, we go, how could you not understand? I could see it coming.
Yep.
It's like, well, it's because it's coming at me like a million miles an hour. That's why.
Yeah, exactly right.
But even if you've got, you know, you're coaching and I see where that sort of coaching often turns into like commentary coaching.
Yeah.
Like, you're just sort of saying what's happening out there rather than anything that's... Because
It's not even joystick coaching.
No.
Because nothing changes.
Yeah, and it often is coaching in twos.
Yep.
So it's...
Get it.
Yeah, run, go. Like, coaching in twos. But what the worst part of all of that is that when your players start to realize that's how you're going to coach and they'll almost start shutting you out. And then when you do have a genuine directive or something to tell them, they won't hear you because they've literally just you become white noise. It's like if you're similar to what you were saying before, Rob, if you're always like yelling or if you're always at one level, when you try to go to that level to make a point, it won't hit. Whereas if you're at that you know, more calm level, then when you do go there, it's like, whoa, we've made an error. Like, so it's a similar sort of thing.
All right, Zoe, on to your next one.
The need to fill every spare second consuming content, basketball or coaching content. I'm not saying don't work hard, of course, but there was this and it was very early, when I was very young in my coaching, where I thought I was scared. I was so far behind that I had to catch up. And so to do that, I had to read every article, watch every clinic, talk to every person, do all this stuff to try and catch up. And it was exhausting and it kind of made me not like vast coaching anymore because I had no time to me to be able to just be me and, you know, have fun and miss coaching a little bit too. So, you know, I see a lot of young coaches in this, you know, if they're not watching a EuroLeague game or an NBA game or something like that, then they're wasting time. It's like, no. You might just be resetting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might just be coming back to neutral. You might just be, I don't know, hanging out with your friends and family. Like, whereas it takes up a lot of our time already. So I'm not saying don't do those things, but I would be less worried about that you're, you know, if there's something you need to be doing on the night of, say, a clinic or something like that, you know, don't bump the other thing. Find a way to maybe access that clinic so you can watch it at a more appropriate time. Or
it's the first question I get any time a coaching clinic goes out. Like, the email will go out at 12:02. At 12:03, I'll have four emails. Is this being filmed?
They're probably all country coaches, in fairness, but
not always. So you're not helping me here.
Well, I'm sorry, but what my point is, like, I think sometimes coaches get so deep into that rabbit hole that then when, say, they don't get the job that they want, whether it be the first team on a Friday night or a state team or something like that, they think it's all been a waste. And in a way, sometimes it is, because so many different voices can blur the lines. Like,
well, the fact you've even got an opportunity shows that it hasn't been a waste, because there are plenty of people that don't get interviews.
Yeah,
for those sorts of things.
Yeah, there's only a handful of positions anyway. And to your point as well, like, How can you look forward to something if you don't have an opportunity to look forward to something?
Yeah.
Or if you're always in it, you're never really like excited to go to the game or go to the train because it's just constant.
And it starts to become work.
Yeah.
Like all instead the time. Of something you enjoyed.
I speak to coaches as well, mainly my assistants, and just talk to them about when are your times that you have off where you're not thinking about scout or coaching or your own junior teams on a Friday night. What days are they? Because if you don't have any, it is a problem because you're not gonna last for 5 years. You're probably gonna last for 6 months, yeah. Right? Like it's difficult.
All right, my next one.
It's Rob's rant. He's on the mic complaining about stuff he just don't like, from bad parking to soggy chips. Rob's rants on Talking Split.
I know what you're thinking, Nick, and no, I had no intention of playing that music until I told you no, you weren't getting it played on yours. And then I thought, yes, I will
story.
Be petty.
I don't care. I'm happy with that because I just wanted to hear the song.
I understand that completely. Conditioning is part of our job as coaches. Absolutely not. Like, you have got to be kidding me. The amount of times I've talked to a coach, and love them for coming to me in the first place. The autocorrect coming back is usually fairly pointed. Our team's unfit. We need to do more conditioning, so we're just going to run them at training. What on earth do you think is going to come from that other than your team is going to hate you? Like, genuinely think about how much training it takes to get fitter in the first place. If you genuinely want them fitter, play more games in your training session where they don't get a break. Like, that's how they'll build fitness. By sitting there saying, oh, we're going to do the beep test tonight, and we're going to see how fit everyone is, you are going to have comfortably an entire team of annoyed kids at you. You're going to have that really, like, deep shiver in your soul of the boo-doo-doo when you were in primary school and secondary school and you had to go and do it. Like, vomit-inducing feeling.
Is it also King Drill? Is that what it's called? The one where they go, left.
Oh, the mass defensive drill stuff. Yeah. Conditioning is not our job in isolation. Conditioning is our job to facilitate it through gameplay in our training sessions. The more you can have them in things and the less time that you stand around talking and giving them a novel on what coaching should look like because this is what it was back when you played, the better off we're going to be. Get them active. That will get their conditioning levels up. That will get them used to playing fatigued. That will get them used to having to make that shot when they've just run around for 40 minutes and they've got nothing left in their legs. That will get them to a position where they've got to make a decision when they've got very minimal oxygen in the brain because it's all being expelled out their mouth because they're tired. Conditioning is not our job as coaches. Yes, you have to be a certain level of fitness to play at various levels, for sure. And if you are at the professional level, sure, you get an impact on what conditioning looks like. You get a say, but you also probably have an S&C coach.
Exactly what I was going to say. You're probably directing them to people who know what they're talking about as well.
A 5K run is not going to work on their physical conditioning for a game. It's not the same level of fitness. My under-14s, I think it was under-14s coach, we turned up one night for training. In fact, we turned up one night for practice and the coach was on the phone and had prepared no session. So the training session for the first 20 minutes while the coach was on the phone was, hey, run around the school. And it was the most obvious thing I've ever seen in the world of, you've put no thought or plan into this. This is not making us any better. All it's doing is annoying us.
And now I hate you.
Do you reckon they would have noticed if you just ran home?
Potentially not. Like, funnily enough, that's right, I'm doubling down.
I thought Rob's rant song was going to come back on again.
I do remember it was when I was an assistant coach, so I can't claim all responsibility for this, thankfully. We had a team at Diamond Valley 1 year that had to do a little bit of a run. It was like that was their run they used to do before training would start, as like their warm-up and, you know, team bonding and all that sort of stuff. Ridiculous now that I look back on it, but different problem altogether. They had to run it wasn't even a block. I reckon it was maybe 2K was their run that they had to do, but there was a cut-through area that you could go through that would cut off a good, like I'm talking a good K. And it was only when the time started getting better and better and better and the head coach is like, hey, yeah, conditioning stuff is really working. It's like, I don't know that it is. Like, we still look like we're fatigued on a Friday night. Like, this is not really making the impact. And it's like, I happened to be walking somewhere one time and I'm like, hold on, I reckon they're cheating here. And so they go off on their run. I go and sit at the park and all of a sudden I see like first player go through, second player go through. And it's like, yeah, they're all cheating the system.
Elite.
Here. Like, solid work. That's awesome. Like, way to problem solve the issue, but it's like, fellas, you got to know this is not a good idea. But, you know, under 18 boys don't always make great
did
decisions.
Did you job on them?
Absolutely.
Oh, you're the worst.
No, accountability. No. Exactly. We're after in this. Like, you
they found a solution.
It's called you honest feedback,
should
Zoe.
Be patting them on the back. They found a solution.
If they could find a solution to be up by 10 and not give away the lead at the end of the game, I would have been on board with it, but they couldn't. So,
because turns out your coach only had the runs.
Yeah, exactly right. That's not fixing the issue. Yeah.
But like a good one for that sort of stuff, if you happen to have a full court, is like 4v4 full court, but like 10 second or 8 second shot clock. And that gets them going.
Yeah,
and
cooked early.
You only need to go for 3 minutes.
Yep. And they'll move faster than a suicide.
Oh,
I guarantee you.
But they're also absolutely wrecked at the end of it. And then you go again. Yep. And then
and if you can, while they're absolutely wrecked, make them shoot a couple of free throws.
Yeah.
Because, again, that's what they'll experience in a game. Mm. So, yeah, do not lob into a training session and say we're working on our conditioning. Absolutely.
But also
not.
On the flip side of that, there needs to be a level of accountability to the athlete too. Well, like, don't rock in thinking that you can play, especially at a higher level. You know, a big thing for me when I was coaching NBL 1 is pre-season is for us to get our, you know, schemes and X's and O's and all that sort of in. If you're not fit, that's on you and you won't play. Mm. Like, and that's got to be, I think, a part of a psyche shift of the coaches aren't responsible for putting you, you know, oh, I'll just wait till preseason or I'll just wait till this.
No. I know you said it, but I do have to be very clear. The level is dependent on that.
Yes.
Junior basketball I'm talking about here.
Yep.
Do not be punishing players for a lack of fitness. Like, and look, to be fair again to the players, play so hard the coach has to take you out.
Yep.
Like, that's what we're really after in that. You're talking a very different space. You are talking senior basketball. So I do want to make that clear that that is, you know,
perfectly. But the premise is the same.
Yeah, it is.
I'm as their basketball coach, I don't believe I'm responsible for their conditioning.
Yep.
Like, you come into this conditioned. So then we can start rather than...
Otherwise, you play the players that are conditioned.
Correct.
That's if all you're it wondering is, how to do that, go for a 2K run before your training session, which sometimes ends up as 1K.
Yeah.
Yep. Find the shortcut.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll see Rob sitting on the bench.
Those kids will go far.
You'll see Rob sitting on the bench watching them run past.
You know what? They haven't. And that's okay.
You don't know that.
I do know that. I still know all of them. you're on, Nick. On to your next one.
I need to be exactly like my mentor coaches to be successful. So early on in my coaching, obviously, I admired a lot of coaches. I was very privileged to be around some very experienced coaches with some very recognized names, and I thought that I had to be them to be successful early in my stages, and I didn't realize that it was what they were teaching. I needed to use my personality to apply it. And that's what I learned later on, which is completely different. Like, there's in this room, I don't believe there's any two coaches the same. I think we're all individual in our own way, but we do have similar values in terms of what we coach. And I think that's the most important, one of the most important things that I learned and got rid of is that, like, I don't need to be Mark Watkins, Nick Adasevic, David Crow, whatever, you name them, Scotty Christensen, you know, but they have important information. Right, they've obviously have been successful over the years, but you've got to apply your personality to it.
Yep, and that is challenging. I think, especially it's that identity theft almost that you're looking for as a coach. And you know, I look back on the fear as the worst motivator. And you know, I probably was a byproduct of a lot of people, and I had the same behavior and traits and those sorts of things that I exhibited, not realizing that there's a different way to do this. And that wasn't my personality. It became my personality, but it wasn't my personality. And that's not where I was going to see success. And the success wasn't even the winning. Like, the success was just the player relationships, the management, those types of things. That's where I feel like it came out a little bit more. So I think it's good to have people you admire, people you respect, and those sorts of things. No problems whatsoever. But yeah, be very careful about just trying to duplicate. Like, it's that whole, you know, you can't photocopy a photocopy and expect it to still be good quality. Like, it's the same thing.
And when you are going, okay, you know, the identity theft is a good way of putting it, right? Like, you're only really copying the surface level.
Yeah.
You don't know what they're doing behind the scenes, the conversations they might be having with players prior to these sessions. Like, you don't know what's happening. So if you just carbon copy it, you may only be copying 30% of it which if it doesn't have the other 70% of conversation, it can be disastrous
as well. And I think I said it the other day with our Accelero Women's Group, we were talking about it actually. And it is one of those things that the praise you get in public is the price you pay in private.
Mm.
And you don't realise what all of those coaches have gone through behind the scenes to have that way of seeing, communicating, tinkering, those sorts of things. You don't know any of that stuff. You see the surface level stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's nice, but it's not all of what they are either. So you got to be careful there, I think.
Yeah, I think because that also then it's one of the things is a big part of what we're doing at the moment is trying to make sure that we're not making every coach just a worse version of us. Like those, you've got to be able to have your own voice, have your own opinions, have your own ideas, your own philosophies. When you're in our program, the idea is that you teach what we need taught your way.
100%.
So that's, you know, don't try and be a mini Zoe because one is more than enough. We don't need more Zoes.
It's one of those times I was looking for like an amen soundtrack or something like that, but I didn't stand that one. Yeah.
But it's something I think particularly younger coaches fall into a little bit, trying to almost mimic people well,
we,
that have
we
helped
did
them.
As younger coaches. Yeah. That's why absolutely I, you did. Know, every yeah. time we go, oh, wow, look what they've achieved. You know what I mean? You just, it's hard. It's hard to stop it before it happens. I think you've got to go through it, don't you?
Yeah, but on the flip side, I think mentor coaches need to be better at holding them accountable to that as well, of the sense like if you're a mentor to a coach and you start seeing them just basically be you, nipping that in the bud early, saying, hey, like start throwing some questions at them where they have to come up with their own answers and their own thoughts and opinions and things like that. So then it's just prompting that, I suppose, individual thought.
Mm. Yep.
Definitely. Zoe, you're on to your next one.
Oh, it's my last one.
It is.
And it is that you need to be in a low, low stance defensively. Like remember back in the day you used to have that really wide – I still believe in a wider stance, but that wide and like – so low that you could touch the ground type.
From a playing capacity, no, I'm not familiar. from a coaching capacity, yes, I remember trying to get kids to do it.
Good. And I'm with Rob on this one, by the way.
Yeah. Well, I used to believe in it because, again, that was what I was taught and forced to go through, which was awful. I don't believe in it now. Not for everybody, for some. Similar to the shooting, for some it works and it's great and they can move. Generally, shorter players have the ability to do that because they play at a lower center of gravity. But we sit there and we've got these athletes who, you know, their legs are three times longer than their torso and then we're trying to get them to sit right down. It's just not – sometimes it's not possible.
Like they're sitting on a chair, right? Yeah. Like all lower.
And then we wonder why they can't move.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of
push off the outside foot. That'll help.
And you see there's some athletes that, you know, they play in a what would be considered an upright stance, but they stay in front of everybody. And ultimately that's the goal, right? So obviously – and there's been some data come out about particularly in – women and girls, when they, especially girls, once they've gone through puberty and they start to have gain hips, sitting in that stance is actually dangerous to and put you at more risk, a higher risk of ACL injury.
Yeah, right.
That real – and I'm talking that extreme, that extreme low that you know, and we used to have to sit there and in that stance like a wall sit but – without the wall helping us, that sort of stuff. So, yes, you still need to be in an athletic stance, of course, but sometimes, you know, if the athlete's staying in front, sometimes if it's working, I'll just take let
that.
It go.
Absolutely. I will take that gladly.
I'll take that as well, by the way.
My next one is that early specialisation was a good thing and I couldn't have been more wrong. And, again, the naivety of a young coach that thought that VJBL basketball was the most important thing in everybody's life because it was the most important thing in my life at that stage. And if you didn't meet my level of commitment to it, then you weren't good enough and you shouldn't be playing here. And why are you even going and playing footy in the first place? It doesn't make you any better as a basketball. You need to be playing basketball and you need to come to this session. And yeah, cricket. No, we don't play cricket on Friday nights. We play basketball on Friday nights. You need to be at our basketball games on a Friday night, even though it's a small part of the actual year that you play VJBL. You know, those 6 weeks were vital to what it needed to look like. And in reality, I'm so far from that at the moment, it's not funny. Like, I am all about go and play as many sports as you can possibly play that your parents can afford and get you to and facilitate and all those sorts of things. If you have the opportunity to go and play other sports, play other sports. Like, all the information, very well-researched data will tell you that if you play more sports, you will end up being better overall at everything else. There is time to specialize and there is time to enjoy, and we shouldn't be confusing the two. So when we talk about early specialization, it is I'm going to have an individual skills trainer in under 12s. I'm going to play 4 games of basketball per week. I'm going to see no other sport or no other way of playing. I would love kids to go and do an individual sport as well as a team sport, as well as some form of combat sport. Just those sorts of things I think are really valuable. Like, diversity in what they go through I think is far better than all eggs in one basket, because how many kids have we seen flame out in a crashing heap at the age of 14 because they just haven't developed into what they wanted to develop into? So for mine, early specialization in the bin.
I actually think that's getting worse, by the way. Yep. I think the early specialization, like you said, kids are getting skills trainers at like 10 years old. They're training 4 times a week, not including their team sessions, domestic games, Friday night games, and Sunday morning sessions, and school basketball. So they're doing all of this all together. They don't have time to play other sports, where you're right, they should, right? Like, the studies have supported that as well. Like, we're seeing it too. We're seeing basketball players go through the age groups, particularly on the boys' side, not sure about the girls' side, but on the boys' side, where they're just missing out on state teams, things like that, and then they're going into the AFL because they've been playing both sports, for example.
Well, and how many kids have we seen that make basketball their entire identity because that's all they've known and that's all they've ever done? They get a setback and all of a sudden their world comes crashing down around them and they don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
Like, have other options. Like, go and play other sports that you'll enjoy. Don't make the sport your identity. I'm not saying don't play basketball, because of course I want you to play basketball. I think it's the greatest sport in the world. But just be aware that you can't put everything into this and nothing into anything else. Like, it's not healthy. Like, it's just not healthy.
Mm. Well, so, and if you're worried about, I know I want to be a basketballer, then play other sports that complement rather than, AFL, you do get a bit of, I think we did a pod on it once about what we get from other sports. But a
bit of toughness.
Yeah, you get some toughness and physicality and that sort of stuff. But overall, you're probably, from a skill set perspective, not gaining as much as you would say in like soccer, in terms of footwork and space and time and playing in a
conditioning.
In a small space. Conditioning, yeah. but that Which sort is of our stuff. Job. or swimming. So you're taking some pressure off your joints, but you're building a completely different
lung capacity.
Or like you said, like a combat sport. Now all of a sudden, that King Richard movie.
Yeah,
I am. Oh, I want somebody to hand me their child. I've got the answers to do what he did.
Zoe working in human trafficking now. Would you?
No, actually, sorry. I don't want them to give me their kid. I want them to follow a plan because don't want the kid.
Well, that's slightly more ethical, so we're okay there.
It's still in the same bag though, Zoe. It's kind of
but it's like little athletics, learn how to move. But if you can move, you're halfway there. So learn how to move in all their different events that they have at Little Athletics. Then you can start playing some basketball. And then while you're doing that, go and do something like a combat sport or dance, like ballet or – and this goes for the boys too. Like I've held on to it for I don't know how many years. Every time I think about it, and when James Herb played, and one of the things they always said about him was his unbelievable balance and how light he was on his feet and being able to
bit of a hot topic, old James Hurt at the moment.
Well, he is, yeah. But and he put that down to he did ballet as a child. And so those sort of things, when I talk about complimenting, go do some things if you're worried about it.
A lot of boxers did salsa dancing for transfer of weight on their feet.
Yeah. Mm. So you can still not specialize, but be adding to the thing that you love and that you want to try and be successful at.
Yep. Nick, we're on to your last one.
Last one. Bit of a surface level one. Repping the zone offense helps you score in zone. So basically, you come up with this great idea for a zone motion, which is just a continuation offense that keeps going on and on and on. And you sit there in 5-on-0 and you get the players to go through it until eventually they memorize it. And once they memorize it, you apply it in the game and then we'll continually score without actually telling them what the weak points are in the type of zone that's being run against you. So for example, like if I could just go back and say, throw the ball to the high post in the 2-3 and get the ball to the corner and get it out in a 1-3-1, that would have been a lot easier and I would have saved so much time. There's hours and hours of time where I could have just taught them how to do that part.
Yep.
So
It sort of ties into like repping your offense 5-on-0 type stuff. Like, is there really a lot of value in that? Like, yeah, okay, sometimes it might be worth taking the defense off the court so they can see what it looks like at times, but I'd rather them see it with the defense. Because that's what they're going to see in the game.
So. But there's also, like with the zone offense, there's always, you know, you go through it. And so then when the defense comes on, they go to those exact spots. And that might not be where the space is.
Yep.
And so it's all like what you're actually trying to teach is, like you're saying, get to those where is the space and fill that rather than just, you know, it might not be the high post. It might be like the old dotted line. You know, that might be – you might be open there and just get a catch and shoot there. Go there, you know.
And then defense, what they do is because they've seen it on zero, they don't want to upset the coach, so they kind of allow the catch a little bit to make it work a bit. And it's like, yeah, see what I mean? It works.
Yeah.
Yep.
It doesn't.
I drew that play.
Yeah, there's a bit of that about it. And this is the thing, I suppose, with any of this. We've all come from various backgrounds with our coaching. Don't hold on to opinions like your life depends on it. Mm-hmm. You can change, you can evolve. There is a reasonable chance that if we were to record this in 15 years' time again, we'll have changed on something that we really firmly believe in now.
Yep.
It's going to evolve. The sport evolves, so we have to evolve.
Do you think your stance on conditioning will change?
Nope.
Yep, okay, just checking.
There are some hills you just need to die on, and that is one.
Something to post on Facebook. Let's go.
It's like me on Twitter.
Okay, a social split talk for this week was one I just happened to catch as I was flicking through. I don't even know who's talking. I did try and find out who the runner was that was talking about this, but I don't know who it is, but we'll play it out.
My Olympic coach told me after a particularly challenging workout where I could not hit my splits before going to the Rio Olympics, that was okay. It was the rule of thirds. I was like, what's the rule of thirds? And he said, when you're chasing a dream or doing anything hard, you're meant to feel good a third of the time, okay a third of the time, and crappy a third of the time. And if the ratio is roughly in that range, then you're doing fine. So today was the crappy day along your dream chasing. And if the ratio is off, like you feel too good all the time or too bad, then you got to look at if you're fatiguing or not trying hard enough or pushing yourself.
You know what I think that clip needed?
Less music?
Louder music.
Yeah, no, tell me about it. I did all I could and that's what we've ended up with.
I enjoyed the ambiance. That's just
anyway. Exactly right. You know, I feel far more relaxed now because of it. So it's, but I think a valuable message all the same. I mean, life as well as coaching. You can't win every game. You shouldn't aspire to win every game. You shouldn't aspire to lose every game by the same token. But you do want that little bit of push and pull, like you spoke about before, Nick. Like, how do you miss something if you never get the opportunity to miss it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's that kind of thing. It's, yeah, some days it'll feel great and it'll feel easy and you'll just, you know, it'll just roll off the tongue almost what you're doing and on court, and you walk out of there going, damn, that was a really good session. You could go and deliver that exact same session a week apart and it'd just be an absolute certifiable disaster, and that's okay too. The goal is to not stay in one of those three spaces for too long. I think that's the challenge for a lot of us.
I saw it more as like, you know, as a coach, you come in and you go, you're really excited about a session. And then another week, it's like you've had a long day and you're not as excited, but you still just got to show up because you're just going to have those days where you're a little bit more tired than you were the last week.
Yep.
and just to be consistent with it. That's how the message I got from it as well.
Most definitely. And it's, you know, the reality is there are going to be some days like that where, you know, for whatever reason, it's been a day at work and, you know, then you go to training and it's like, oh, okay, they fed these kids sugar all day, it feels like. And, you know, now I've got to try and corral all this energy into something that looks like basketball. That's going to be a tough gig. So hard to do, to be fair. But I do think perspective helps. And it's not going to be good all the time. It's not going to be bad all the time. You just got to try and work out, you know, am I roughly a third all the time? So I think that's the challenge for all of us. Coaches, thanks very much for listening. Zoe, Nick, thank you both very much for jumping in. We will be back again next week on the Talking Split Pod.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.